Hi, welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We get out of the studio and onto the road to find the kind of radio you don't hear so much anymore. Stories off the beaten path and usually away from the top headlines. We figure the weekend is a good time for that. Time to lean back a little, slow down, meet somebody interesting, hear what people are saying. Of course, when we're not on the radio, you can catch up with us on Facebook. Just search Indiana Weekend. And we'd love to hear your thoughts about the show, your comments, thoughts about whom we might talk with, or where you would like to hear our microphones. Our email address is, conveniently enough, indianaweekend@gmail.com. I'm John Strauss. Halloween is coming up, and with it comes a rest, finally, for the folks at Howell Farms in Henry County. Besides corn and beans, on their 6,500 acres, they grow pumpkins. And this time of year, they ship more than 1.5 million pumpkins to stores across the country. Doug Beal is production manager at the farm near Middletown. When we caught up with him recently, he was catching his breath after a hectic 7 weeks of harvesting and shipping.
It really starts winding down about the 20th, 25th of October is really the end of the pumpkin season. Nobody wants a jack-o'-lantern after Halloween.
I would think that could be really tricky if you got a lot of rain right around that time. I mean, what are some of the things that come to mind for you?
That is always a concern with a pumpkin crop. 2010 was a very wet fall for us, and we actually had to haul pumpkins in here to the barn, and we're actually washing jack-o'-lanterns by hand, trying to get clean pumpkin out to the buyers, out to the grocery stores. That's one big thing people don't realize is how much time and effort it takes to get these pumpkins shipped out. The buyers, the grocery stores, the Walmarts, the Myers, the Lowe's, the Kroger, all those stores are looking for a perfect pumpkin. They have to have a good stem. They have to be clean. Although these pumpkins are grown out in the field where there's dirt, the pumpkin has to be clean, free of dirt, free of blemishes, good, nice, hard stem. And it's a challenge, and in a wet fall really makes that a big challenge. This year, there were several days we couldn't harvest. We had several days where we had some quality issues because of the rain.
So here we are at Howell Farms at Middletown.
Mm-hmm.
About how many acres of pumpkins do you all have?
This year, it was right at 440 acres of jack-o'-lanterns, and there was about 60 acres of pie pumpkins. The pie pumpkins are a smaller softball-sized pumpkin. They're a meatier pumpkin. They aren't as hollow as a jack-o'-lantern, but the vast majority of those are still used for decoration on porches and so forth. I mean, there are a few people that still cook with them, but most of them, the vast majority, are used for decoration.
Talk about where we are. Right now, we're standing in.
This is our...
Looks like an airplane hangar. That's what I feel like we're in.
It's a really nice building we put up about 10 years ago. It's 100 by 200. It's a wide open warehouse. We start using this the 1st of September when we harvest pumpkins. We have three loading docks here. We bring loads of pumpkins in through the back door and get them offloaded with forklifts, and we load them on the semis with the loading docks. This facility at times, I wish I could show you some pictures. I mean, we could hold 20 semi-loads of pumpkins in here pretty easily, and it's just, we fill every crook and cranny.
Now, we're standing next to a box that I'm going to say is about the size of I don't have a hot tub, but that's what this looks like. I mean, this is, and how many pumpkins does that hold?
That one right there is what we call a 40-count bin. It's a cardboard bin that's 3 foot tall, sits on a 48 by 40-inch pallet, and that's how the buyers buy them. You'll see those in all the grocery stores. It's a 36-inch tall bin, and depends on that one we call a 40-count. It's got 40 pumpkins that's supposed to be filled to the top, and we do all sorts of sizes, like a 25-count. 18 count is our largest one we sell this year. There'll be 18 pumpkins in the bin, and those are really large.
Those are
really
big,
large.
Yeah.
Yeah, really large pumpkins. So we go all the way up to a 60, 70 count sometimes. It'd be a volleyball and smaller.
Now, you mentioned the number of semi-loads that you'll have out of here. Roughly, about how many pumpkins would you say that you ship on a good year? Oh, he's cutting his calculator out.
And
I'll let you go ahead and do some
I'm
figuring.
I'm trying to
here.
Do some math here.
This is a farmer today with a smartphone. This is high tech.
I mean, in an average year, we'll ship over over 1.5 million pumpkins. In an average year. We're just a small...
That's a small operation.
It's surprising how many pumpkins are shipped throughout the United States. It still amazes me every year what we get done, what we're able to accomplish in just a matter of 2 months. And there's growers like us all across the U.S., all across the Midwest.
October is just a busy time for you. I mean, describe for people what that's like.
I think it was last Thursday was probably the first time since about September 1st that I had time to sit down with the family for a meal in the evening. That's what it's like. It's just long hours and constantly trying to battle the weather and trucks and trucking and help. It's just a constant battle all fall.
Because you have to do it when you can. You have to do it when the conditions are right.
Right, correct.
If you wait a couple of days or you wait a week.
Not just the weather conditions, but you're dealing with the trucking industry. You're dealing with buyers that you know, you have your day all planned out, and at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, a buyer calls and needs 3 more semi-loads, and you have to try to figure out a way to get that worked in to your system and to your harvest schedule. If you tell that buyer no, they aren't going to wait for 3 days until you have the pumpkins. They're going to go find those pumpkins somewhere else. That buyer has a store somewhere, a warehouse somewhere that needs those pumpkins, and you have to be flexible and be willing to adapt to get that done.
Folks driving north on I-69, somewhere north of Daleville over on the east side of the highway, will see something like 100 acres of your pumpkin.
Yeah, we have a farm just north of Daleville. It butts up to I-69. There's 110 acres of pumpkins there. And we've had several people call because they've seen that driving down the highway. But what you see from the highway, some of those pumpkins are still have a green cast to it. You know, the stores won't allow anything that's got any kind of green color to it at all. They have bad stems from the rain or a big part of what you see out there is frost damage as well. We had 2 really hard frosts that came in and really damaged a lot of the pumpkins here late in the season. But we're done with that field, and it's amazing driving down the highway. Every year, it's rather frustrating driving by a pumpkin field, and you think, boy, there's just thousands of pumpkins out there. But once you take a walk and a drive and start inspecting this pumpkin and that pumpkin and this pumpkin, and you realize that the stores, they really want a really almost perfect pumpkin, and it's hard to do sometimes, but we try.
Sowing in the sunshine, sowing in the shadows, fearing neither clouds nor winter's chilly breeze. By and by the harvest and the labor ended, we shall come rejoicing, bringing in the sheaves, bringing in the sheaves.
That's Doug Beal, production manager at Howell Farms in Henry County, southwest of Muncie. They ship about 1.5 million pumpkins. As you can imagine, with Halloween just a few days away, they are tired. Working very long days since the beginning of September to get the crop in, this is the time for a rest, finally, down on the pumpkin farm.
Indiana Weekend, real radio from just down the road. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line to let us know what you think at indianaweekend@gmail.com. Now here's John Strauss.
You know, public relations gets a bad rap now and then. In politics, there are the spinmeisters whose job it is to explain what the candidate really meant when suddenly overcome by foot and mouth disease. But especially in this time of great change in the traditional media, the role of public relations is changing. In external communication, newsletters are replaced by blogs, news releases replaced by tweets, all in the name of strategic communication. A public relations professional who's seen those changes, and many others, is John Graham, president of Fleshman Hillard for 32 years and now chairman of the company. He visited Ball State recently for the Schranz Lecture in Public Relations, and we had a chance to talk about the trends he sees in communication.
The first of those is the continued globalization of business. I mean, and the communications around this is absolutely vital. I mean, you're operating off a 24-second news cycle, not a 24-hour news cycle, and anything that's news in Beijing, it will be news in New York or any place else instantly. And this really has impacted the way that our clients operate, many corporations, many governments operate, to protect their reputations. And they have to get local input, what's important locally in figuring out their overall global strategy, communication strategy.
Are there opportunities, do you think, for nonprofits and community stakeholders?
Absolutely. You know, you need to be open. You need to have discussions. If you're either in a positive situation or you're in a negative situation, I mean, the best solution is to have an open discussion about it. And the discussion is going to take place with you or without you. And it's a good thing for you to be part of the discussion.
As you talk about the increasing globalization of the communications mm-hmm. field, naturally, that's going to put you in contact with a variety of countries, degrees of openness, degrees of oppression. Does this create greater ethical challenges for companies that are operating internationally?
It does indeed. Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you can, you know, you can operate ethically, totally ethically in 48 countries and in the 49th country where you don't, look out, because it's going to impact your reputation, your worldwide reputation. And it calls for a whole new standard of ethics. And you have to operate in one country just as you do in another country. It's interesting that a lot of our international clients, clients who are based in other countries, are learning this. And some of them have had to learn it the hard way, that wherever they operate, they have to operate in an ethical way, or it's going to come back to really hurt them and their brands. You know, this is another one of the trends, and that is that it's the rise of reputation is really overriding the importance of branding, because you can spend millions and millions and millions on your branding, but if you foul up your reputation, your brand, all the money you spend on your branding is going to be a waste.
Amid all of the technological changes that we see, there are still some fundamentals that you have to get right.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. And even with all the changes, and if you apply the basic principles that apply whatever communications vehicle you're using or whatever the speed is, you know, A, you want to get across your best messages. That one of the things that's changed, by the way, in messaging is the use of analytics and the tremendous amount of data that we have available to us, which we didn't have 3 years ago. I mean, that recently. And that's changed. And that's changed the whole way we message. But a lot of the basics are still in place. I mean, still basically you want to put together your good messages, your good stories, and you want to get them to the right audiences. And that, of course, has changed also, because the audiences, the way the audiences absorb information has changed dramatically over the last 5 years.
I'm thinking of an agency in Indianapolis that took on a pro bono client, a religious order of sisters, and they built a website for them. It included a place you could write in a prayer and light a virtual candle. And it occurred to me that it must be fun or tempting sometimes in the industry to say, hey, I want to help these folks out.
Oh, absolutely. Pro bono work is a big part of what we do. Number one, your staff wants to do pro bono work. And our objective is to keep our staff as motivated and pleased about their jobs as we can. And certainly pro bono, we take on pro bono projects at the suggestion of our staff. And we'll allocate a certain amount of time to allow our staff to do pro bono things. Absolutely.
Here you are on a college campus. You're speaking to young people. What are you telling them about the kinds of skills that they need to possess going out into the world and with an interest in professional communications?
I think one of the things that is still basic to our business, and I'm a firm believer in writing, and I think you have to be a good writer, you know, because, and I can say this because when I joined Fleischmann Hillard when I was a fairly young man, I was not that necessarily a good writer, but I learned to write. And I learned the importance of writing. It helps you organize your thinking. It's basic to everything we do. And I think creativity, the more creativity you can bring to your job, is extremely helpful. And then, of course, there's just hard work. I mean, we really, really salute people that go the extra mile on behalf of their clients to get something done.
You mentioned creativity.
Yeah.
You must think from time to time. Where does that come from? Can you teach creativity? Can you learn creativity?
I think you can. I honestly believe that you can. If you can set the right atmosphere, that I think you can both teach and I think you can learn creativity. We have creative sessions where we bring in our top creative people from all over the world and put them together in one room and have them tell stories about the work they've done for clients. And coming out of that, everybody learns things. Sure, I believe you can teach it. You know, it's we'd all like to say we're God-given creative geniuses, but the truth is that it's probably a learned capability.
John Graham, chairman of Fleshman Hillard Public Relations, on the nature of creativity and how the field of communications is changing. He stopped by the studio while on a visit to Ball State for the Schranz Lecture in Public Relations.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss on Indiana Public Radio.
From you, I get opinions. From you, I get the story.
It's funny how so many of the things we take for granted travel such an interesting, convoluted path to our stores and homes. I thought of this the other day, driving north of Daleville, saw a vast field, about 100 acres of pumpkins. I thought, how do they get all these pumpkins to market on time? I asked around, found out the farm is owned by the Howell family from down near Middletown. At Howell Farms, I met Mary Howell and then operations manager Doug Beal. By now, they're finished with the harvest, and as you can imagine, there's a lot involved when you're picking 1.5 million pumpkins.
We had 7 crews of people, about 9 or 10 people in each crew this year, and they will go out first thing in the morning with pruners, just regular old hand pruners, and cut every pumpkin that's orange and ready to go. Once they get a section of the field cut, they will go through by hand, carry them from the field into driveways. We have a driveway every 94 feet, so they're carrying them from the right and left side of the driveway, putting them in a windrow, which is a big long row right beside the driveway. And then once they're dry, that's the other thing about pumpkin harvest, you can't harvest them when they're wet because they'll get muddy and slimy looking. You have to let the dew dry off, so we usually start in the early afternoon. And we drive the pumpkins, we drive the buses or the semi-trailers or the wagons through down that driveway, and the crews are loading them into the bins.
You got to have a strong back to be picking up 20-pound pumpkins.
Yes, we have some wonderful people that have been coming back here for, we've had some of the same people, some of the same crews for 3 or 4 years coming back here every year harvesting, and it's a very tough, very challenging job, but we're blessed with a really good, really good workforce.
Is it hard finding people to do this kind of work?
It is, yes. It is very hard. Even for people to just drive the school buses through the field, it's a challenge to find them. We use a Hispanic labor force for harvesting the pumpkins, and they are about the only ones that will do it. We've had some others that have tried and just work a day or half a day and they're done.
By the way, I can imagine you and I were doing that, right? We'd be going after a few hours, we'd say.
Every year we have cars parked along the road just watching these crews just throw pumpkins all day long, just nonstop throwing pumpkins up to the other guy who's putting them into the bin and guys putting stickers on them. And it's just every day we have people stopping and, you know, how they do that. Boy, that's amazing. And it's interesting to watch.
You had states where they got tough on immigration law, and they didn't have people to bring in the crop.
In the state of Indiana, there were some new legislature that was in the process of possibly being passed this past summer. It's something we depend on, and people just don't realize how critical that is for agriculture to have a dependable workforce. To get these crops in, whether it's pumpkins, strawberries, lettuce, tomatoes, all those crops depend on a good, dependable workforce. And we've been blessed with a good one, really good people we have working for us, and they've come back year to year. It's a challenge dealing with that. You're always having to deal with negative or wrong perceptions of Hispanic laborers.
Do you have to explain to people, look?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do. We spend a lot of time, Mary and David Howell, they spend a lot of time talking to people at the state and at the federal level trying to explain what we do, how we do our practices, what services we provide to those people, and how we follow the law from A, B, C, D, all the way down. It's a constant misconception about pay rates, for example. A lot of these farms pay the workers on a piece rate. They're guaranteed a minimum per hour, but you pay them on a piece rate. We pay them by the bin. You would be surprised. There wasn't a week this pumpkin harvest that these guys weren't making below $11 an hour. Many times, I mean, several weeks, it was quite a bit more than that. So this isn't below minimum wages. They worked their butt off for it, and they deserve every darn penny and more. They work very hard and do a very good job. But this isn't, there's a perception out there that they're getting taken advantage of by agriculture, and that's totally false.
Did you grow up in farming?
I grew up about 5 miles south of here, and my family didn't farm. I started working here when I was in, I think it was seventh grade.
What was your first job?
Picking up rocks. Adam Howell, a friend of mine from school, asked if I wanted to go pick up rocks.
And this would be because during the tilling of the soil, rocks come up?
Exactly. During the tillage process in the spring, rocks are pulled up, and you just have to get those rocks out of the field for soybean harvest specifically. And that's when I started.
Did you study this in school or anything afterward? Or
Yes, I did. Started here in 88 and just really gained a real passion for agriculture and a love for farming. Went to Purdue and got a degree in Ag Systems Management in 97.
What is it about this that keeps you here? Because this isn't an easy job. You've hardly seen your family since August.
It's hard to describe sometimes, but I mean, this is the time of year where it's all worth it. When you see all that work and preparation, even from the beginning of winter, when you're making your cropping plan and making all those decisions that are going to make a huge impact on what this farm produces and how we continue to make our living off this land. From beginning to end, from what's done in the winter, the decisions that are made, to the spring preparation and planting season and all through the summer, it's amazing to watch what turns out at the end of the fall.
Doug Beal, production manager at Howell Farms near Middletown, southwest of Muncie. They farm about 6,500 acres and just finished shipping their pumpkin crop over 1 million jack-o'-lanterns. Doug barely saw his family during September and October while the harvest was coming in. Now, as winter approaches and they bring in the rest of the corn and soybeans, it's time to plan for next year. That's our show for today. I'm John Strauss. Big thanks to our producer, Marcus Jackman. Glad you could join us this time and hope you'll stay in touch. Drop me a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com if you would like more information or have a suggestion. Reminder, we also need your stories, your ideas for places we should go and people we could talk to. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week. Until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio, I'm John Strauss.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss of the Ball State Journalism Department. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Marcus Jackman. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from Dillman's Furniture, Muncie, serving East Central Indiana with home furnishings from Flex Steel, Bassett, and Simmons Beautyrest. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.